We are only going to consider the first seven chapters of Conference 14, the Conference of Abernethyros on Spiritual Knowledge by St. John Cassian, in this lecture. The goal of our study of these first seven chapters will be to be able to see the interrelationship between what Cassian describes as the life of praktiki, the life of asceticism, of ascetical striving, seeking after virtue and seeking to expel the vices on the one hand, and what he calls the contemplative life, the theoretiki, on the other. These are terms he takes directly from St. Evagrius Ponticus, as one can see in the Practicos of Evagrius. For Cassian, these two dimensions of life are intertwining. You must be engaged in the praktiki. You must be engaged in this ascetical project of rooting out vices and seeking virtues in order to have the inward clarity to see, to have the vision of God. But the other thing that this conference makes abundantly clear is how very true it was that for the early monks, the contemplative life consisted primarily in the spiritual interpretation of the scriptures. That is the substance of this conference. Beginning with chapter 8, the section we won't be considering in this lecture, Cassian makes it clear that the goal of the theoretiki is to be able to interpret the biblical text at multiple levels, to be able to see beneath the surface into the deeper meanings that lie within it, and then, as we'll see later in Cassian's writings, to be able to apply this skill to the world at large, to look at created things and see within them the God who made them. But the principal thing we're interested in these first seven chapters, is the interrelationship between these two poles and the degree to which praktiki, asceticism, is the cornerstone or the ladder leading up into the experience of contemplation. Now, it's not just a simple stepladder, however, because in order for one to be able to really undertake that inward journey, that experience of finding out what within the self needs to change, that needs to be done in a progressively more contemplative fashion. One needs to be able to apply to one's own story, to the book of one's own life, so to speak, the skills that one learns as a contemplative in interpreting the scriptures in a mystical sort of way. So the two are actually more complexly intertwining than just you have to do asceticism first in order to behold God in the mysteries of the scriptures. Actually, the two reinforce one another and lead into and out of the other. But let's just look for a moment at chapter 1. We have Cassian describing for us the fact that there are all kinds of knowledge in the world, and that our disciplina, that is to say our system, that's the word that is sometimes used to translate in the later monastic tradition the word rule, our approach to monasticism has its own proper system. And the first part, he says, is praktiki, which is subdivided in number 1-3 into an improvement in morals and purification from faults. In other words, seeking the virtues, getting rid of the vices. And the second, theoretiki, is the contemplation of things divine, the knowledge of most sacred thoughts, which for him occurs primarily in the context of what we would call lectio divina, finding God in the scriptures. In chapter 2, he describes a general sense that one does have this stepwise and intertwining nature of the relationship between these things. In order to ascend into the experience of God, one must paradoxically have grown in the kind of humility that allows one truly to be a child of God. This is a theme which Benedict will take up, actually deriving it ultimately from Cassian, from other texts in Cassian, via the Master in his own Ladder of Humility. And in chapter 3, we have a description of what Cassian calls the double system of the praktiki. On the one hand, to know the nature of our faults and the way in which they can be cured. So one has to understand the self. The praktiki depends on an understanding of the innermost self. And second, to understand the order of the virtues, the order, ordo virtutum. That is to say, which need to be acquired first and in what order? What are the things in our lives that need to be set right? And is there a kind of a natural progression within that transformation? And as we'll see, that Cashin very much believes there is. He believes that one has to start with the most natural and basic human drives, the inescapable ones, beginning, of course, with gluttony, beginning, of course, with the experience of taking in food, and that one has to acquire a balance and discretion in regard to one's intake of food. One has to discover moderation as a virtue in order to make any progress in virtue itself. So he makes it clear that this system is twofold in Numbers 3:2 by giving a kind of a biblical reference. He uses the reference from Jeremiah that the prophet is supposed to be involved in a rooting down, a pulling down, wasting and destroying on the one hand, and a planting, a building up on the other. For Cashin, this is the expulsion of vice and the attainment of virtue, a kind of definition for him of the practice, or of what we would call asceticism. In chapter 4, he points out that this practice, this seeking of God in the project of understanding the choices that need to be made, the elimination of vice, the discovery of virtue, this will be unique to each individual depending on the particular form of life in which God calls them. And this can be a source of confusion for us, because Cashin does not mean by practical life, or what we might call active life, he does not mean any particular form of apostolate. And he's not distinguishing between an active life that would consist of being involved in some particular kind of external work on the one hand, and what in modern times, since the 17th century, is called contemplative life, referring to life within a cloister, life within a community from which one ordinarily does not move. That is not how Cashin uses the term. For him, the active life, the practice, is pursued in a variety of different contexts, and the first one he lists is what we would call the ultimate contemplative. The practice, this life of seeking after virtue and expelling vice, is to be found for some in the context of solitude. Elijah and Antony are examples of the fact that the holy hermits, the paradigms, the classical examples of contemplation, are engaged in their own particular form of practice, of asceticism. And number 2, he points out that this labor for ascetical growth can also take place within community, within the cenobium. To be responsible, to have administration over a cenobium, can be an important ascetical project. So can hospitality in number 3. That's a particular form of virtue that all are called to exhibit, including those who live as solitaries. He mentions that some practice virtue and seek after virtue in caring for the sick. Others are particularly devoted to prayer, for interceding for others. And notice, for him, this life devoted to prayer is not the contemplative life. It is a form of practical living out of the ascetical project in a particular context. As we'll see, although Christian prayer is an exercise even beyond, in a certain sense, contemplation in the system of Evagrius on which Cashin depends, for Cashin, this is the practical, ascetical milieu of life in which one seeks after virtue that then facilitates the project of beholding God particularly within the context of one's praying the scriptures, which is the whole substance of the second half of this conference, which we won't be looking at in detail on this occasion. In number 5, he talks about the essential nature of persevering, continuing in the particular form of life to which a person is called, so that you live out your particular form of asceticism in the context to which God's called you. And if you want to engage in a kind of a little intriguing exercise, compare what he does in chapter 5, those, I've numbered them 1 through 7, sections of Romans 12, 4 to 8, compare those with the examples of the 7 different kinds of practical life he describes in chapter 4. In many ways, this text from Romans has inspired him, and he's trying to point a biblical parallel to a description of the kinds of ways of living out virtue with which he is himself familiar. Skipping down then past chapter 6, which we won't be looking at, to number 7, he concludes his discourse by giving an example from one of the lives of the Desert Fathers. This is a tradition he inherits from Evagrius. At the end of a particular series of teachings, to give examples from one or several Desert Fathers, it signals the end of a very important segment of teaching. Evagrius does exactly the same thing in the Practikos and in the Gnostikos. In a way, it's calling upon a known example of a living person to validate what you've just been teaching. And the point that he wants to make in chapter 7, of course, is that different people are called in different ways, and holiness can be achieved. Ascetical practice is to be lived out in the particular context to which God has called you. And here it's the story of Abbot John discovering an astonishing holiness, a capacity for spiritual power, for the gift of exorcism, in an individual who he would not have suspected of being such a holy person, who turns out to be a farmer who lives a very holy and just life and is living in continence with his wife, which Abbot John discovers is actually, in its own way, a higher asceticism than anything he has known in the monastery. So Cassian is very much aware of and open to the fact that ascetical practice, the experience of spiritual discipline, must be tailored to the unique circumstances of a person's particular call in life, and that it prepares for, leads into the project of discovering God beneath the surface, especially of the scriptures, but also beneath the surface of ordinary human experience.